seen it all in basketball, from great success on the court to a total collapse off the court. Born and raised in Boston, he grew up on the Celtics and local college basketball. And when he turned out not to be athletic enough to make it as a player, he became a coach. Starting out at a local Catholic school, he worked his way up the ranks to become the head coach at Cleveland State. He recruited city kids like he had been, tough kids from tough backgrounds who had something to prove and a desire to improve their lives. You know the kind, everyday people. He won big there, peaking in 1986 when his team finished 29-4 and as a 14 seed upset Indiana in the first round of the NCAA tournament. But what began as underage drinking became a full-blown alcohol and drug addiction. And in 1990, he was arrested after he emerged from a crack house with a hooker. That turned out to be a blessing, however, because he finally got the help he needed from former NBA guard John Lucas. He eventually resurrected his coaching career in the minor leagues, and then one day he got a surprise call from none other than Larry Bird, which is why today he's the scout for the Pacers. There's a lot to talk about, so let's get going. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Kevin Mackey.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions. They make your memories last forever. And Robin Run Village, Central Indiana's finest continuing care retirement community.
All right, today's one-on-one episode comes from the fifth floor studios at Emma's Communications downtown on the Circle. We're here with a basketball lifer, to say the least, Kevin Mackey, Pacer scout, a man who's got an incredible story to tell and a huge amount of history within basketball. Kevin is from Boston, as you'll soon find out by the way he talks. Kevin, tell me about your childhood there growing up. What did your dad do in Boston?
Yeah, my father, God rest his soul, he was a teacher. And in the summer, he ran the recreation program in the city. He was a gym teacher. He became a vice principal and a principal of a middle school. And, of course, in the summer, the recreation in the city, all the sports. And I was encouraged early on in the sports, and he loved them. And he used to take me to all the games, the Red Sox games, the Patriots when they came, and Celtic games. I went to a lot of Boston College games and the whole thing. So I was in it at a very early age, and I loved it. So it's been terrific, and it's something that stayed with me my whole life.
Yeah, you weren't given a choice to be a basketball fan. Did you grow up like in the city?
Well, I grew up in a place called Somerville. Now you can put in Boston, you can put 1 foot in Boston and one foot in Somerville, and there's one spot you could bend over and put your hand in Cambridge. So for the people, geographically, So I grew up right on the Somerville-Boston line, and it was great. Basketball was very big, and Red Auerbach was doing his thing with the Celtics, and it was a great time and a great experience.
So you must have been growing up when, like, during the 60s when the Celtics were winning all those championships.
Bob Cousy. I grew up with Bob Cousy, Bill Sharman, and then, of course, he made the brilliant move, the greatest winner of all time. He brought Bill Russell there, and it was, the 11 championships. I always felt, in my opinion, Auerbach was light years ahead of everyone in the NBA, and Russell always did what was necessary to win the game. And Red had a great eye. With you can just go on, and I know we don't want to just talk about the Celtics and all the players, but
that's right.
They he did a great job.
Did you go to a lot of games?
I went all the time. Every time I could, and I saw Oscar Robertson. I never missed Will Chamberlain when he came to the Garden. I saw great, great players, Elgin Baylor, Dolph Shays, Bob Pettit, just tremendous players. I saw Oscar Saturday. I had the Alabama at Cincy game, and he sits right in the front row.
Yeah.
I was telling the guy, he's the only, most players I was pretty good at figuring out how many points they had. Oscar, he got it so easily, He was so good. I would be off by half. He'd have 35 or 40. I'd be saying, well, he's got 22 or 25. And he just made it look so easy. And I don't know if we've ever had anyone like him. Jordan is special in his own way, but Oscar was something else.
Now, were you one of those fans throwing eggs on the floor? I
mean, I
can remember watching games on TV, like Sixers and Celtics, and fans would be running on the court or throwing eggs or throwing light bulbs.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Stuff.
Well,
it
it's like
crazy.
Everyone else. Yeah, you're crazy. No, I was way into the basketball. I rooted for the Celtics big time. But the Celtics, as everyone knows, it's history now. It's a matter of fact. They won all the time. So it was easy to support a team that won all the time. And, you know, we loved the players, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it had to be. Now, strict Catholic family, right?
Yeah. Irish Catholic. My uncle was a priest and became a Monsignor, my father's brother. So, yeah, I was an altar boy when I was a kid. So
I read one article where it said that one side of the crucifix, you had a picture of JFK, on the other side, Ted Williams.
Right. Yeah, they asked me, someone did an article. My mother had a picture. She loved JFK, and my father loved Ted Williams, being the Red Sox fan. And then when Larry hired me, I said, Larry, we're going to put I'm putting a picture of you up next to the crucifix. Larry's wife, he told me his wife got a big kick out of that.
But she didn't actually do it. where did you play? Like, where did you develop your game as a player?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I played. There was a lot of local basketball in the parks and recreation. There was CYO, Catholic Youth Organization, was very big at the time. St. Pauli Cops, in those days, we thought they were the biggest games in the world.
Sure.
And then later on, I went to Somerville High, and then I was a Division II player. I went to St. Anselm's in New Hampshire and played there. And I realized one night, I later coached one of his sons, the greatest college player in the game at that time was a guy out of went to Providence. He was originally from Boston, named Jimmy Walker. And Jimmy had 50 points in the NIT, and he'd go around his back and between his legs. And he was not only great talent, but fun to watch. And Jimmy was light years ahead of, you know, all of us. And one night we were playing, and that time it was supposedly illegal by the NCAA for you to play in the summertime, which is the craziest rule I ever heard. And we were all playing. They called it. It was down in Quincy, or North Quincy, Mass. The YMCA league, they called it the Smith League. They put your regular first name, and then everyone on both teams was named Smith. And so at the end of the game, they'd rip the only source that said there was a game, they'd rip up the box score at the end. So the game never happened. Anyway, we're playing against Jimmy Walker, and I said, I want to cover Walker. And the guys looked at me, and they said, Kevin, are you crazy? And I said, let me try. That night, the game started. He went by me like I wasn't there. I could still remember it in living color. And I was doing everything I possibly could. And I knew. I said, I know this guy's better than me, but come on, he can't be there. And I had no effect. It was like he was out there by himself. I went home that night and looked in the mirror and said, hey, your career is over as a player. You want to do this, you better figure out another thing. And it took me about a week. I said, I'm going to become a coach. And that's when I went into the coaching. And that was the night, though, that I realized that I didn't have any future as a player.
That's when your coaching career began. And you probably are aware Jimmy Walker was the first player the Pacers ever drafted. When the ABA was formed in 1967, their first round draft pick was Jimmy Walker.
Yeah, well, Jimmy was a great talent. Later, I had one of his sons who was a good player at Cleveland State. And, of course, they had a great one of his sons played here.
Jalen Rose.
Yeah, Jalen Rose, and is now a big TV guy doing a great job.
Yeah. Mackey begins his coaching career starting out at Cathedral High School. The one in Boston, I mean. When One-on-One continues. We got to live together. I am everyday people. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Today's guest, Kevin Mackey, wasn't a great player, so he had to begin his coaching career amid humble surroundings. He had immediate success by going after the city kids and worked his way up the ladder to a head coaching position at Cleveland State. you started out as a high school coach.
I started out as a high school coach at Cathedral High. It was a Catholic school right in the urban area in Boston. And when I went in, I spoke to the priest who was the athletic director, and he said, Kevin, I was 21 years old. And he said, why do you want to coach here? I'm not sure we can pay every week. And I said, well, Father, I have a teaching job in the public schools in Somerville in the junior high, which they now call middle school. And I said, it's a good job. And I said, but basketball is what I want to do. I know that. I want to be the coach here. And I said, if you can pay me, great. If you can't pay me, that's great, too. I'll be here every day, and let's see what we can do. And he says, fine, you're hired. And we get started there, and I loved it. I realized I want to do it 24/7, and we had a lot of success at Cathedral. We won New England Catholic Class B championship, and then one of the school down the street, was building a state-of-the-art facility, and I worked with the guy at the junior high, Northeastern Junior High. He had been all-Catholic, all-American at Boston College and last cut 2 years in a row by the Celtics. His name was John Silt, and he was the vice principal of the school and the head coach of Don Bosco. And he said to me, Kevin, I can't do it anymore. I'm just going to be the athletic director. I want you to come to Don Bosco and win the state championship and win the New England Catholic championship. We're going to have the best facility in the city. And I said, oh, man, that'll be terrific. I want to go there. And I went to Don Bosco, and the busing was going on. That was the mid-70s. And I was blessed and fortunate. I got to know everyone in the city, and we got the best players from both sides of the tracks. Everyone wanted to go there. We were ranked fourth in the country a couple of years in a row. We won the state championship. We won three straight New England Catholic Class A championships. And all the players basically were getting Division I scholarships. And so it was a wonderful time. And it was just terrific for me, and learning, growing, how to be a coach, and it was so much fun.
Even at the Catholic school, you kind of built your program still with inner city kids, didn't you? You weren't afraid of taking a kid from the inner city and working with them.
I saw right away. First of all, both schools I coached at, Cathedral and Don Bosco, were located in the heart of downtown Boston, so the kids in the neighborhood were kids. I mean, I used to see them playing and the whole thing, and I said, hey, these kids are gifted physically, they're hungry, they want to do this, and this is a way out for them. And I would tell them, fellas, you got to go to school, you got to pay attention, you have to be polite to the teachers, and you have to work hard at this basketball, and I want you playing basketball every day, 365 days a year, and because that's how you're going to get better. And there's summer leagues, there's fall leagues, There's spring leagues, and in the winter you'd be playing for me at Don Bosco, and we'll move this thing forward, and you'll end up getting a scholarship and getting a good job and having a good life. And a lot of them listened, and a lot of them moved forward and were recruited by all the schools, and it was terrific. And yeah, and so I got the reputation of taking basically 80-85% of my guys, 90% were all urban kids, inner city kids, and we had terrific success with them. I try to tailor the way I play. I stumbled into the full court press, and by accident, I became a great believer on it, and I did it in high school, had a tremendous success with it. And then when I went to Boston College, Tom Davis and Gary Williams were the head coach. Tom was the head coach, and Gary was the first assistant. And Gary only stayed 1 year, and then he got the American job, American University. And Tom moved me up to be the first assistant. And they both were pressure guys. They believed full court pressure. So the system grew. And at BC, we had three Sweet 16s and Elite Eight, two regular Big East championship. Dave Gavitt had just invented the Big East, which was a stroke of genius, and he understood marketing, he understood television, and he understood, I'm going to put this tournament in Madison Square Garden.
Yeah. So how did you get the head coaching job at Cleveland State?
Well, like I said, Tom Davis was terrific with me. Gary Williams left to go to American, and then Tom went to Stanford. Gary came back as the head coach, Gary kept me for a year, and I had recruited Michael Adams and John Bagley. John went to the NBA. He was the 13th pick in the first round. Michael was still there. Michael was a sophomore. And we won 25 games that year. It was the most Gary had ever won, and he went to the Sweet 16. And Cleveland State had called me, and at that time, Dave Gavitt was the head of the Big East, and Mike Trangese, who later became the head of the – was the assistant commissioner, and they told me it's time for us to get our top assistant guys head jobs, and they had it all planned. They said the first two guys who are going to get jobs are going to be Kevin Mackey and Brendan Malone from Syracuse, who now is a veteran NBA.
Right.
He was a head coach and now is a veteran assistant coach. We're going to get them jobs. They're going to be the first ones. And they did, because when I went out to Cleveland State, the first thing they said, we talked to Dave Gavitt. And at that time, that was a big, big deal.
Yeah.
Dave Gavitt called me and talked to me. And I knew right away when I walked in the door, I was getting the job because Dave was that powerful. And so my recommendations were very good. Our record at Boston College was fabulous. So I got the job at Cleveland. I had the idea, the run and stun. We were going to press for 40 minutes on their case, in their face, take away their space. I felt that I feel this way today for all the people that are way into the basketball. I feel on the negative side, our kids today, too many of them lack the understanding of how to play. They lack a skill set because they don't put the time in the gym, serious repetition and game speed. But what they don't lack in Division I is great athleticism, run, jump, long arms, quick feet. And the good ones will listen to the coach, and the coaches use them to play like some of the schools in the Big East, some of the schools in the ACC. They play great smothering defense. But if the youngster doesn't put the time in on his own, like I saw when I came to the Pacers, for a name everyone here knows, I saw what Reggie Miller did, hour after hour on his own. Larry Bird hired me. I talked to the point where I drive Larry crazy. Larry, I said one day, how'd you get to become Larry Bird? He said, great answer. He said, Kevin, all day, every day. Is there any other way? I said, I'm going to steal that line and use it. That's a great line to tell a young man. And the skill set, and obviously people used to say about guys like Larry, well, he's 2 and 3 plays ahead at all times. He's the smartest guy we've ever seen play. They said that about Magic. And then Michael Jordan was a legendary preparer, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Same guy now that works with Kobe Bryant. And so the great ones, they understand what the price is and that you have to pay. And to accomplish, to be really a great scorer, to be great with the ball, you have to put in a great amount of time. You've got to shut the music off. You've got to send the girlfriend to the mall. And you have to get in the gym every night, 2 or 3 hours on your own. If you're not doing 500 makes a night, don't tell me you're going to be able to shoot the ball. You know, and I see these kids with all the ability in the world, and they can't shoot free throws. I tell them, I can find an 8th grade girl in Indiana shoot 85%. And, you know, they roll their eyes. I'm saying, hey, this is a business, son. You know, you want to get paid? If I bring your name up to the Pacers, I won't have a job. I can't recommend you. And I tell the coaches that. I said, tell the kid. I said, you know, I don't have a problem with it. And I said, because I'm just telling them the truth.
Yeah.
And I think we need a little more of that today with our talented young people who so they'll know what it takes.
That's how you built the program at Cleveland State, is that you went into cities and told kids the truth, right? And
I told them the truth.
They sensed that and they wanted to come play for you.
If they would work, if they pay the price, no one would be tougher on them than me. But at the end of the day, we would win games. I said, I can evaluate talent. You're blessed physically from God and your parents, the way you can run. In my best day, I couldn't dream of moving like you move, and you're just the type of guy I want in my program, the type of guy who used to shut me down when I was a kid as a player. And I realized it was a very simple equation. For me, I need to go out and get all the guys, the type of guys who gave me a hard time. And right away, the toughness, the defense turned into winning, and I saw that. And then I also learned about the offense, that if you want to be an accomplished offensive player, the price you have to pay, is there's no shortcut. There's no shortcut. A college coach can't do it for you. He can tell you, you have to do it. A great high school coach can tell you, can show you, can't do it for you. You can watch the video of Reggie Miller, Larry Bird, okay, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant. That's great to see how they do it. But if you don't pay the price, you're just kidding yourself. There's no shortcut. Drills for skills, nothing but another name for hard work.
Mackey takes on Bob Knight in the NCAA tournament when one-on-one continues. Back on one-on-one, Mark Monteith here with Pacer scout Kevin Mackey. He built the winner at Cleveland State, one that won even as a 14th seeded team in the NCAA tournament when it met IU in the opening round. So you're at Cleveland State 7 years and you average 20 wins a season over that time. Your best team comes in 1986. You're 29-4, and you beat Indiana in the NCAA tournament. From what you just described, your program was kind of the antithesis of what Bob Knight was doing at Indiana, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, I think it was too. However, let me say this. At that time, Bobby Knight had the biggest, and rightfully so, had the biggest name in college basketball. He was the best coach in college basketball. I had everything he had ever written, all his printed material. We had 15 games that we studied before we played them. I felt, to this day, because people, believe it or not, still talk to me about that game and the whole thing. They come up to me and we talk. I felt if we try to play 18 feet on in against Indiana, we have no chance that Bobby will do his thing, work his magic, and he'll just cut us up. And I'll be way over my head trying to coach against. But I believed in the 94 feet, the run and stun. We were gonna trap everything. We're gonna rotate. We worked on that an hour every day. Two on the ball, two in the passing lane, one back. As I had said before, to the kids, on their case, in their face, take away their space, and they became very good at it. It was my third year. I had some of the players 3 years, some of them two. Mouse McFadden, it was his first year, but he brought talent. He could score.
Where was he from?
From New York, Alphabet City. And I got him out of the AAU program. I got him, one of my old friends, Leo Papil, who later became the director of player personnel for the Boston Celtics, who was with them for a long, long time and has been forever one of the top AAU coaches with the great BABC. He had everyone from Patrick Ewing to now he just had Nerlens Noel. So Leo's seen it all, coached them all in the whole thing. And the guy who, Doc Nicelli, God rest his soul, he passed away. It was the Madison Square Garden Boys Club that Mouse played for. And Doc was very protective of Mouse. I said, Leo, you have to go get me that kid. I have to have that kid to start the program at Cleveland State. He says, Kevin, I'll go get him, but Doc's tough. And the Doc said, hey, I don't want to hear anything going wrong. I don't want to hear we can't do the work. And you take him. He's your kid. You take care of him, and you get him through in the whole thing. I want to hear a success story. And then if you do that, and this was the New York way, and I understood it, and it was a good way. If you do the right thing by him, there'll be more coming after him. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I talked to Doc, and Doc says, Leo tells me that you're a stand-up guy, and this kid's just made for your program. I said, he can do everything that the players I have can't do. He's a special offensive talent. And Mouse was the all-time leading scorer in the history of Cleveland State and the all-time assist guy. Mm-hmm. And he was a great college player. And he wasn't the only guy there. We had some great local kids. We had transfer players. We were an urban university. And I used to tell, hey, this isn't a Sylvan retreat. We want to get guys who want a concrete campus. They're happy in the city. And I saw right away the kids, a lot of them from the main streets and the fifth floor of the housing project, brought that toughness that I place such a high value on. And I would say, hey, fellas, you've seen it all. And you see the college is a good, clean place. It's somewhere where you can thrive. You're going to be the first one in your family to get a college degree, and your life's going to be different. Mm-hmm. You're not going back to the housing project. And they bought it, and I sold it to the mothers, and the mothers wanted that. Mm-hmm. And they wanted their their young man to have a chance. And so, I mean, that's the American way.
Yeah.
And they traded their basketball talent for an education. And we had, we were blessed. We got some great kids, and we had a great time.
What became of Mouse McFadden?
Mouse now is he got his degree. He's a social worker up in Cleveland. His life's a terrific success. I mean, he came from, I personally can't go into his personal story background because obviously that's private. He came from very tough background personally, mm-hmm. and his success for him to get a college degree and for him to make it out of where he came from is absolutely tremendous. Now, I realize that every kid doesn't have the ability to play basketball. When you do the right thing, my son played basketball at Harvard with Arne Duncan, who is now the Secretary of Education in the United States. And I spoke to Arne one day, and he said, my father and I was going to fill your ear. He says, yeah, I know what kids you had. I said, hey, why don't we open the schools in the urban area 24/7, so they'll have safe haven, the kids, and so they'll be able to go there, use the library, use the gym, use the swimming pool, use the cafeteria, and the whole thing, be around some good people who have the best interests at heart. And he said, Kevin, that's the best program I've heard. And I said, well, it's easier said than done. I understand, but to me, it's a natural, because one of the things, and that we have today in this country, it's fabulous facilities mm-hmm. everywhere. And I think we need to use them. And now, when a kid comes from a tough situation, I think you have to give them a chance. Now, basketball-wise, obviously, it's to the coach's interest, the school's interest, to graduate them and to say, and so it's all good. It works hand in hand. The young man benefits. Everyone benefits. It's a win-win. But if the young man or young lady can't play basketball, that doesn't mean there shouldn't be help there. If the family is not capable of providing it.
Right.
Because a lot of cases, a lot of times, let's be honest, that's the case.
Absolutely.
There's nothing good coming from some of the neighborhoods and the families. So there should be a safe haven for everyone, because I've been all over. I've been at the best schools, the worst schools, everything in between. I've seen it all now with my scouting and recruiting in this country, and the opportunity is there. So give a kid a chance, and then if he doesn't take advantage, you gave him the chance. It's on him.
So that game against Indiana, I remember watching it on television, and I almost started laughing because after the game, you win. Big. What were you seeded?
Yeah, we were 14. You were
14.
And they
Indiana.
Were third.
Yeah. They were three. Yeah. Big upset. Nobody around here had heard of Cleveland State. Right. And this is 1 year before Indiana wins the national championship. So we're talking 1986. And after the game, they interview you on the floor and you say, hey, it's a black players' game and this is how we play it. I mean, I thought that's great. I mean, that's
I got a little carried away. Our kids were all, basically, most of them were inner city kids, like I said. But Bobby Knight was great to me and great to our program, great to the school when the game was over. In the interview room, he was absolutely wonderful, first class. I can't say enough good things about him. And then we saw, I would see him along the way. I bump into him, and he always very gracious and the whole thing. And I'm really happy he's still in the game, mm-hmm. doing the TV, and people should pay attention to what he says, because the guy is devoted his whole life to it, and his message might not be for everyone, but you can gain a great deal from it. And like I said, I felt we used his base of defense as the bedrock where we built out on it. Mm-hmm. And what we were doing was probably a full-court version of a lot of his fundamentals, because I knew they were very sound, and I understood that he built his thing from Pete Newell and Claire B when he put his philosophy together and how he did it, which always interested me. Where does this come from? How did you arrive at it? But and it was great for Cleveland State. It changed everything. There was no place for the kids to stay. They bought a Holiday Inn right across the street from the school. They called it Viking Hall after we went to the Sweet 16. And then they built a new gymnasium, a new arena, 13,000-seat arena right on the campus. So it changed a lot of things forever up there, and which was great. And now you look, every year, every other year, there's a big upset in the tournament. one of the lower seeded mid majors who's not on the TV all the time. And those kids are frothing at the mouth. They want their opportunity. And when they put their time in and they have a good coach and a good program, they'll get every year, every other year, there's a big, big upset. The people love that about the tournament. It's a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I would think at that point, like in 1986, did you have offers to go to so-called bigger schools?
Yeah, well, they started to come in then. And of course, I was grateful to Cleveland State. And, you know, I had a radio program, a TV program I was doing. I worked for Puma, doing ads on TV for Puma. Then I was doing ads for McDonald's. Then I went to, I switched from Puma to Nike. And so it was all great. And that was the beginning of the thing, the way it was starting to grow and take on almost a life of its own to what we have now, $5 million plus coaches and TV deals in the billions. And
yeah.
It's a part of the entertainment show business, sports, college sport industry that we have today. And it's just incredible how much money is generated by the whole thing. And that was a little bit by my experience in the Big East and then the way Dave Gavitt grew the Big East and then going to Cleveland State, I came with all that background and those ideas and that hey, we could move this thing forward.
Mackey takes a hard fall when one-on-one continues. But first, here's the final seconds of Cleveland State's upset of IU in the opening round of the 1986 NCAA tournament.
10 seconds left. Ramsey's going to go to the line for two more, and the Cleveland State Vikings are getting a standing ovation from this crowd in the Carrier Dome.
When we opened up about an hour and 50 minutes ago, we told you that Cleveland State felt as if they could win this ball game, and they were sincere about their thoughts, all the way Vikings, it says. We may be watching the Cinderella team of the NCAA 1986. Number 44, Clinton Ranzen, who has 27 points, will be stepping up to the free throw line. Dries the socks, his hands off on the socks. We'll have one in a bonus. What a story the nation has seen this afternoon in basketball here. Rebound belongs to Indiana.
Indiana doesn't have any timeouts. Cleveland State can just, they don't even have to bring the ball inbounds.
Alford just 24.
He can just hold it. That's it. Game's over.
If you're riding Cinderella, send her mail at 2451 Euclid Avenue, Cleveland, Ohio, because they have just advanced today as Cleveland State. Kevin Mackey rejoices as his team has beaten Bob Knight's Indiana Hoosiers. The final score is Cleveland State 83, Indiana 79.
We're back on one-on-one. Mark Monteith here with Pacer scout Kevin Mackey. He thought he was bulletproof at Cleveland State with all the success he was having, but he found that wasn't quite the case. Eventually, it took an unexpected call from Larry Bird to resurrect his basketball career. What was your contract when you started at Cleveland State?
Contract, I think it was like, I don't know if it was $40,000.
About $40,000 a year. Yeah, typical for that
era.
Yeah,
it was very typical of, yeah.
And after you won in 86,
it went way up. it went way up. And then, of course, that was when, you know, all the things you got because you were the coach. I mean, I had a shoe contract. I had a TV deal. I had a radio deal.
Yeah.
I did a coaching video. I mean, and that you were an entrepreneur, and all that money started coming in. And then, God rest his soul, one of the greatest college coaches of all time, who won a national championship, is no longer with us. But in fact, I'm going to his tournament tomorrow night. Jimmy Valvano, he called me, said, "I want to come up and I want you to give me the pressure defense, the run and stun." And he said, "What can I give you?" And I said, "Jimmy, I want to learn how to make a dollar. No one can make money in the coaching business like Jimmy V." Mm-hmm. And Jimmy, you know, we'd be making $1 or $2. He'd be making $20, $50, $100 doing the same thing. He came up and he started talking to me. And one of the major messages was, Kevin, you like to talk. You grew up on a street corner where you came from just like I did, and talking the sports, the whole thing. People will pay for that. You can go out and speak. They'll give you $1,000, $2,000, $5,000 a throw.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, that's manna from heaven. And I started doing that. And I could not believe, like, the speaking engagements and the whole thing. And
yeah,
the amount of money. I'd go talk for 45 minutes. The regular conversation I'd have every day with friends, or like we had today, Mark, yeah, before we get started. And they'd hear people, oh, this is wonderful inside information and all that. And, of course, you know, part of it, a big part of it, had to do, hey, this, you know, we took an unknown school to the Sweet 16, Bobby Knight in Indiana and all that.
Yeah.
So that at the time we were a hot program and a hot coach and all that. And it was great, and you learned something.
Yeah, we should mention that you not only beat Indiana in the first round, you won your second round game against, was it North Carolina?
No, we beat St. Joseph's, and then we lost by one and at last second play to the great David Robinson.
Navy, yeah.
One of the all-time greatest NBA players ever, top 50 player, Hall of Fame player, just a wonderful, one of the all-time greatest college players and one of the all-time greatest NBA players, and a wonderful person, and I've seen David since
that. Yeah.
He always brings the game up.
Yep. So you get all this success and fame and money pouring in after the 1986 tournament. Did that contribute toward your personal issues that came up later?
Yeah, well, I think you have success or failure for a combination of reasons, both ways. And the thing I didn't realize has been well documented. 22 years ago, I was arrested coming out of a crack house 2 weeks after I had signed a new contract. I had everything going for me. I was addicted to drugs and alcohol. And so I went places I shouldn't have gone. I was with people I shouldn't have been with, and doing things I shouldn't have been doing. And this is for anyone who knows anything about addiction and Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, that type of thing. That had the power over me. Now, we talked earlier off the air about coaches and having control. Most coaches are control addicts. You have to be, because they hold you responsible for the program in college, the players, and the whole, the success or failure of the program. And so the thing is, I believed in my heart, after I got arrested and I talked to different people, I thought I had everything under control. Yeah, I was doing it, but I had it under control. I could put it down at any time. And I realized after I got in trouble, after I got fired from my job and the whole thing, I went down to John Lucas Treatment Center, and John had been through it himself.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first pick in the first round. He was a first-team All-American in basketball and tennis, which is an incredible twosome at Maryland, and a long time, 14, 15, 16 years NBA guy. And he was addicted while he was in the NBA half the time. And he's a special human being. I said to him, John, how can you get involved now that you put this stuff down and you're living a clean life? And how can you get involved with these addicts who are in the middle of all their problems, losing all their money, losing their jobs, losing their families, because that's what they promise you. You lose your family, you lose your job, you probably lose your freedom. And at the end, if you keep doing it, they promise you, you lose your life. It'll kill you. So that's all part of when you go for the education, the treatment, and if you go to an AA meeting, an NA meeting, and this stuff is constantly repeated to you, and it's correct. And part of the thing they also teach you is, you keep your sobriety by giving it away. What does that mean? It's a great line. You keep your sobriety by giving it away. What it means is you share your story. If you're in sports, people are interested because in your public property, and that's part of the reason you get paid as well as you do. And so, you know, John explained that to me. He showed me the way. He had been there and done that. And John, to this day, he keeps his sobriety. He has to still get involved, and he does, with people who are in the midst of their problem. They reach out to him, and he helps them. He's still doing it. Because I said to him, I looked at the record book one time. I said, John, imagine how good a player you would have been and all the records you would have had in the NBA if you weren't on drugs. He said to me, And I'll never forget it because it sent chills up and down my spine. He says, Kevin, and then I wouldn't have been there for you. I said, wow, that's pretty deep.
Yeah.
And so for whatever that means, whatever's wow. So anytime you can help anybody, you want to, because I've had friends who've had children, they've had fathers,
yeah,
mothers, wives, girlfriends, who've had problems, coaches who have problems in their family, coaches who have problems with their players, where a loved one, someone you care about, where you're going to send them. How can we get this person some help? And so, you know, that's one of the great things today with the explosion of the electronic media. The information is there if you want to seek it out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's all there. And I'm always happy to share my story and move along. Thank God for Larry Bird. He called me and said, Kevin, I know your whole story. I trust you. I want you. You're the first guy I'm going to hire when I return to the NBA.
Yeah.
I just couldn't believe it. At first, I was very rude to him because I thought it was one of my friends using some guy who could do a Larry Bird imitation.
You thought it was a prank call.
It was playing games with me. And then he said, well, how am I going to convince you? I said, well, let me call you back, Larry. And then my tone will change, my attitude will change. And I called him back. I said, oh, my God. And then I apologized. Hey, I'm sorry. I thought it was – he started to laugh. He says, that's a good one. You got friends like that? I said, oh, yeah. I said, I got a couple of guys who are always into playing pranks.
So take us back. He called you, and you said, and you didn't believe it was Larry Bird.
I didn't believe it was Larry Bird. But he had, I'll tell you, I was coaching down in Florida in the minor leagues.
Yeah.
Because I ended up, after I got in trouble, I couldn't get work coaching 13 years all over and coaching the minor leagues and making all the stops. So I was coaching down in Florida, and the phone rang, and they said, hey, Kevin, this is Larry Bird. And I had just seen, and this is going back 11 years, down in Florida, Larry had just been on the TV. I had just seen Larry doing a Boston Market commercial. And so I had his image and his voice in my head because I had seen it 2 minutes on the TV. And now the phone rings and says, hey, Kevin, it's Larry Bird. You know, it was too much for me. Okay?
What'd you say?
Go ahead. Triple X rated and locker room talk, street corner talk, and he started to laugh because along the way somewhere, I'm sure he had heard those words before, and then he was laughing. He said, "Kevin, what do I have to do to convince you?" Then I called him back, and my tone, my attitude changed. Said, "Oh, Larry, I'd love to come with you. Go to the NBA. Oh, man, it's a lifelong dream. What do you want me to do? How do you want me to do it?" And then he says, "We're going to talk every month." And as everyone knows the story, he thought it was going to be Charlotte. It didn't work in Charlotte. He called me the next day. He says, "6 more months out, I'm going somewhere." I had done my homework. I was way into it by then, using all my sources, and he was involved. I said to him that day when he called me back, when the Charlotte thing didn't work out, I said, I understand there's 3 or 4 teams who want you to go with them and be, you know, run their front office. And he said, wow. He says, you're doing your homework. I said, yeah, I'm into it big time now, using all my sources. So he says, well, keep those sources. It's going to happen within 6 months. A Friday came on ESPN in the summer. I was watching the ESPN, and Larry Bird comes on making the announcement he's going to the Pacers. My phone rang an hour later. He says, be in Indianapolis at 8:45. Be in the lobby at the old Conseco, what mm-hmm. they used to call it, and I'll come out and get you, and you come in and meet Donnie Walsh. And I was there at 8:45 Monday morning. And, you know, the rest is history.
I think Larry must face that a lot when he calls somebody and they don't believe him, because when it was rumored he was going to become the Pacers coach in 1997, I actually put a call into Jill Leone, his representative, and she passed the number along. And he actually called me out of the blue. And when I pick up the phone and he says, yeah, Mark, this is Larry Bird, I started laughing because you think somebody's pulling a prank on you.
Well, that's exactly, I mean, really, I'm glad to hear you say that because it's, you know, because you talk about, you have this whole thing about going for job interviews and trying to get a job and you mind your P's and Q's and you're all dressed up nice and everything is the best. This was the exact opposite because I thought it was a prank, which of course, you know, he saw it right away. He understood, and he got a kick out of it.
More with Kevin Mackey when One-on-One continues.
Welcome back to One-on-One. Mark Monteith here. Well, we've got a long way to go with the Kevin Mackey story, so we're going to have to come back again next week to wrap it up. He's got a lot more to say about the path that led him to the point he was hanging out at crack houses in Cleveland, and he'll explain how the major college basketball programs cheat today, if you can call it cheating. He's a man who knows all the ins and outs and all the hidden players in the basketball world, and he'll tell as much as he can without risking his life. Now, if you missed part of this conversation or have interest in one of the others in the One-on-One series, all you got to do is go to the website at 1070thefan.com. Click on Shows, click on One-on-One, and click on the podcast link, and you'll have access to all the episodes in the series. You can reach me by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and I can be found on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle is @MarkMonteith. So join me next week for part two of my conversation with Kevin Mackey, right here on 1070 The Fan.